C1SP. Number 9B.
She says that, how does she say that? Very nicely. Jesus restored Lazarus by the understanding that Lazarus had never died. Not by an admission that his body had died and then lived again. Had Jesus believed that Lazarus had lived or died in his body? Both, you see, lived in body and died in body. Had he believed that, the Master would have stood on the same plane of belief as those who buried the body, and he could not have resuscitated it. And so the conclusion is, when you can awaken yourself or others out of the belief that all must die, you can then exercise Jesus' spiritual power to reproduce the presence of those who have thought they died, but not otherwise. See, we find here some very simple but very deep and far-reaching points. First of all, we see, to repeat it again, we see if we go out from the belief that we live in the body, and therefore can die in the body, and therefore hope to be resurrected out of the body, that we start wrong. That then we are on the same plane of belief as those who bury the body. So the first big understanding which we must culture, and the sooner we begin, the better, is more and more to see that life is God. And then from that point, not fall into spiritualism, to say, all right, life is God and God is all, therefore that life is also in my body, because life is everywhere. See, oh, therefore life is in my body. But life can never be in anything. The principle of life is always infinite and never be in anything. And so we have to resurrect ourselves out of the belief that life was ever in body and therefore can die in body and must be resurrected out of body. It's an enormous standpoint, an enormously freeing standpoint. When one begins more and more to look into the universe and to look at our lives and our job and our everything doing from that standpoint, that I haven't a life to live myself, but there is only one life, and all that matters is that one life, then I begin to free myself from the little life. See, to put the one life into many lives. The more I feel all that matters is the one life, which is God, I free myself from the belief that I have a life of my own. And that certainly does a lot of good to the old body. It certainly relieves the body from the depressing thought that I have a life of my own, and that the body is bigger than that life, controls that life, governs that life and puts its signet on that life. And the second, what she says here is that we must free ourselves of the belief that all must die. That we must free ourselves of the belief that all must die. So often we would like to see that just I don't die. Or that just a dear person, doesn't die. Or that we work that one patient or so doesn't die. Well, that's spiritualism. There is only one life. And if I want to demonstrate that I don't die, I certainly have to see first that nobody can die. That life can't die. That's the simple denominator. The understanding that life is an identity, and that identity is eternal, and therefore because life has an identity, it can never die. If I begin to understand that, then I have a universal and therefore a principled sense of life. And then I can help better everyone who is receptive for that advanced idea. Now, in this fifth subject, which we were considering just now, we felt certainly how very often in the text Mrs. Eddy uses the symbolization of the symbol of sleep and dream, how Lazarus was, that Jesus said of Lazarus, he only sleepeth, I go and wake him out of his sleep, showing that the belief of life in matter is a belief like a dream, that it isn't a reality, that nothing can make life in matter real, but that it is a dream, a sleep, out of which we have to awake. And we can awake, she says, by the understanding that life was never in body, never died in body, and never needed to resurrect it out of body. So she shows that the Savior begins to show itself as an understanding of life. And then in the subject of truth, sixth subject, she shows how therefore an understanding of life, of man's spiritual, immortal life, how an understanding destroys the belief of mortal man's existence, or of man's mortal existence. See, understanding is always a savior. And if we look back to the first subject, where we have seen, first of all, what we begin to see clearly is that there seem to be two universes. The universe of the divine mind manifesting itself as a universe of ideas, and on the other side there seems to be a universe of mortal mind evolving itself and forming a universe with lots of things, flowers and men and women and trees and mountains and so on. And then we said, well, are there two universes? Can they be reconciled? No, they can't be reconciled. The second subject said they are different, they are opposites, they never mingle, they can't be reconciled. Well, then the question still would go on and say, well, then are there two universes existing side by side? Then soul comes in and says, no, there was never such a thing happened that from the spiritual universe could fall away from its highest status and form a lower universe of mortal mind, that is not possible, that an identity loses its identity, or it wouldn't be an identity. Soul is identity, and because soul is identity, it can never lose itself. And so it must be just the belief that there is a second universe of mortal mind. In that third subject, you have a lot about belief, just showing that is a belief that there is a third one, but a seeming universe besides the one true universe. But because soul is identity, and because soul cannot lose its innate, its status of being, what seems to be a universe of mortal mind is only a belief universe, a universe of belief. And so, in the fifth subject, Mrs. Eddy comes and says, therefore, all that is necessary is to awake ourselves of a belief in order to get rid of this mortal universe. See, you get a step further. All that is necessary is to awake out of the dream, out of the sleep, in a second universe. And it's the Savior. She shows his understanding. And now here in the sixth subject, she shows that understanding as that which saves us from a belief. That she shows that the consciousness of truth, therefore an understanding of truth, is an understanding of truth. That's the identity of it. That an understanding of truth has an immortal identity, which means that at the same time it cannot be its opposite, namely a belief. You can see that through the Bible, through the textbook, always when we come to truth, there is always the solution of the opposite. Always. It always shows, up to that point, it always shows first in mind the proposition of the opposite. In spirit, usually the proposition that they are, opposites. Then in soul, usually we see that either the one that is higher is superior than the other, that it is an isness and not the seeming. And then in principle, we usually have the tone that behind the isness is a principle, an authority, whereas behind the seeming is no authority. Then in life, we always see that that resurrects us out of the seeming, out of the belief. Comes always nearer and nearer, you see. And finally, in truth, you always have that sense, well, because truth, consciousness, the consciousness is always has identity. Because a consciousness has identity, it can never be conscious of its opposite, or it wouldn't have identity. When I understand that two and two are four, I cannot have an understanding or a belief that two and two are five. I just can't. The moment I touch truth, I have the Savior. But I only can touch truth through the preceding chapters, the preceding subjects, because they clarify and clarify the whole picture, always to the point where I see, all right, yes, that which I hold in consciousness, when I awake from the sleep and dream, when I awake to the reality of being, when I become conscious of that which is true, then that which I become conscious, I am conscious, and I am not conscious of anything which is not of which I am not conscious. There are very simple things, but they must be seen. If I become conscious of that which I am conscious, then I can't be conscious of that which I am not conscious. Very easy. Very easy. See? And that which helps me to that point are always the preceding subjects. The word order is an order of love. It's an order which is the most loving thing. I don't know anything more loving in any science than the word order. Naturally, the word order always afterwards opens the Christ order. That's quite true. But as the Bible shows, and as Mr. Dawley pointed out so often, we cannot enter the city through the east gate. There's only one way to enter the city, and that's through the north gate, through the word. And because the word enables us to enter, it's the loveliest thing. And the loveliness of it is the order of mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, truth. When I touch truth, I can only be conscious of what I'm conscious. And in that consciousness, I cannot be conscious of something of which I'm not conscious. I just can't. There is only one. You see, whereas theodicy is that spiritualistic belief which says, yes, you can. You can know truth and error at one and the same go, because truth knows error. That's a spiritualistic belief. And I have seen recently, I think the last two or three decades, you say decade, Descartes, wait? 10 years or a decade, yeah. It seems, you see, that from the point when Einstein has seen that mass and energy are interchangeable, and he proved it through the atom bomb. That's only the practical application of what he has seen in his theory, that mass and energy are interchangeable, theoretically, and proved it with the atom bomb practically. He changed mass into energy, and into enormous energy. Since that time, I think thinking people who before have not been religious have begun to see that there is a power in mind. And unfortunately, as it always is the case, we always see first the negative part of it. And I've seen that so many people secretly devote their thought and their searching to various systems of mind. And the evil they can do with that is enormous. I have recently had an experience of somebody who was in it. They just killed somebody mentally. They just killed it. Out of ignorance. They couldn't master anymore afterwards mind, but they just killed it. And that's happening more and more. And it's happening more and more. And talking to that very person, he was so sure, that was such a clear statement, that truth knows error and uses error, that there was nothing to talk, to argue about him. Well, that's spiritualism. That's spiritualism as a general denominator for all the many isms and ologies that are going on and will go on more and more in the next few years, until just as material forces have been explained away, so mortal forces must be explained away, just the same way. But I think we are coming into an age which is very dangerous, where the forces of mortal mind are let loose, and they can only be let loose on the assumption that truth and error work together. Only on that assumption. And here, Christian Science stands alone, as far as I have seen and investigated things. I have seen no other science or no other system or no other ism or anything which builds up logically, as she does in the science here, in the Christian Science versus spiritualism, logically and properly and clearly, from the assumption that mortal mind is a power, and the fact that the divine mind is a power, and little by little shows that one pillar, one belief after the other falls, until at truth she comes to the point and says, all is consciousness. All is consciousness. If we are conscious of that which we have seen as mind, spirit, soul, principle, life, then we are conscious of that which is, of the isness of being, of the identities of being. And being conscious of what is, we cannot at the same time be conscious of what is not. We just can't. But to culture that consciousness is the aim of mind, spirit, soul, principle, life. And touching that mind, that tone of truth, we have the consciousness of truth, and in that consciousness of truth, belief is resolved. Which belief? Any belief. Any belief. But belief is always something which is built on a personal human mind. So here in this sixth subject, she shows so clearly how only then when life is understood, that only then the claims of spiritualism will be destroyed. She shows the claims of spiritualism, which are just fundamental beliefs, mortal material beliefs, but fundamental mortal material beliefs which existed and were worshipped long before the term spirit was created and spiritualism was created. You know that already King Saul went to ask the witch, was asking the witch to conjure up Samuel and so on. You see, they are all beliefs. They are older than King Saul. They are as old as astrology, much older as that. It's the belief that matter controls our life, just as astrology does. And by jolly, astrology does control our life, if we can't handle it. They really do. Astrology is another form of spiritualism. Very near to it, has more or less, to a great extent, the same claims, namely that matter controls, that matter can control men. Just as a spirit is able to control men on this side, that the stars up in heaven can control men down here, and so on. So, he shows, as long as we don't have the consciousness, so to say, of the truth of being, of that which really is from God's point of view, that only when we have that consciousness, we can no more be, at the same time, be conscious of a belief, of any belief. And that's our Savior. Then we are free. That destroys the belief. So she says that until, you see, this spiritual understanding of life is reached, until it is reached, she says, well, until then existence will be an enigma, will be a belief of corporeal existence, and death will occur, and spiritualism has its jokes on us. Astrology has its jokes on us, theosophy has its jokes on us, the yogis will have their jokes on us, the whole materialism of the age will have its jokes on us. They just play around with us what they want to play around with us. But we are the master. But we are only the master when we understand the spiritual identities of being. When we do that, understand those, then we are freed. But not before. You see again what I said right at the beginning of this talk today. It's not enough to just ridicule or laugh at spiritualism. As long as we don't have the conscious consciousness of the realities of being, of the true identities of being, until then, even Mrs. Eddy says, until then, all the beliefs will have a chance to govern us. The beliefs of pain, of sickness, of decay, of losing anything, of losing memory, of losing our health, of losing our happiness, of losing our job, of losing our future, our prosperity and so on, has a chance to reach us. So, we can see very clearly, you see, out of this subject, we can see very clearly that spiritualism exists somewhere. Where? In mortal consciousness. Spiritualism doesn't exist by itself. There is no such a thing that it's called spiritualism which exists by itself. There is only one thing that exists by itself, and that's reality, that's God. Nobody can attack the divine mind. Nobody can injure the divine mind. Nobody can. That exists by itself. But spiritualism is a theory a human theory gathered from ignorance, gathered from the testimony of the physical senses, gathered from the belief that mind, small m, and matter cooperate, gathered from the belief that death is the stepping stone to immortality. Spiritualism is a belief, and that belief does not exist by itself. It's not a reality by itself. It exists in mortal consciousness. In mortal consciousness. And every mortal consciousness, every individual mortal consciousness who does not see through that claim is subject to that claim. And in the measure as we don't see through it, in that measure we are subject to it. So, what a relief to see that spiritualism, in all its form of isms and ologies, is something which exists only in mortal consciousness. It exists not only in individual mortal consciousness, but as we will see tomorrow, it exists in a general mortal consciousness, in a universal mortal consciousness. In astrology, it exists in a cosmic mortal consciousness. And the only thing that can deal with that is divine consciousness. So let's get understanding with all our understanding, with all our heart. But just by saying spiritualism is false and not knowing why, and when knowing why, by not building up the fact about it, by not realizing and establishing the fact about it, if we don't do that, we are subject to spiritualism. Then she has a last subject of love, in which she rounds up the whole first part and shows that really that which is a blessing is only spirit. The divine spirit blesses all. Whereas spiritualism is not a blessing. That spirit, that fundamentally spiritualism has pernicious tendencies and therefore is doomed to vanish. Spiritualism has many pernicious tendencies, and she enumerates many of them. And in the earlier edition, she's very emphatic about the pernicious tendencies of spiritualism. Because spiritualism as itself, I mean, just as an interesting phenomena, is just as harmful as is electricity, or is as a motor car, because a motor car has very much to do with spiritualism. It's the belief that mind and matter cooperate. You can't move a motor car without the cooperation of mind and matter, mind, small m, matter. Just as we can't have a table tipping without the cooperation of mind and matter. That's why so often she couples spirits and electricity. And it is as phenomenal or as less phenomenal to see a motor car running as it is to see a spirit moving a table or lifting a table, because both is based on the belief that there is force in mortal mind, and second, that mortal mind and matter cooperate. So we'll see that tomorrow. She explains. She gives quite interesting explanations on that on the next part. But what is pernicious about it is not so much its phenomena, but I think what is pernicious about it is this, that it asks people no more to think, that it asked people to find the guidings in a person or in a spirit. You know, that pernicious tendency which exists also in various parts of Christian Science, that you are no more, that you don't need any more to think, nor to work, but you just can go to the telephone and ring up the practitioner and let him do the job. That's the pernicious part of it. So it is in spiritualism. In spiritualism, if you want to be, want to have guidance, if you want to know something, you go and ask the spirit, and he will tell you. He will tell you which page and line to read in the textbook, or he will tell you what to do, or he will tell you where this and that is. It takes away the finest thing of man, namely to search God for himself, to strive for God for himself, to transform himself. You see, you get the whole prayer now. It takes away prayer. And if it takes away prayer, it takes away atonement and Eucharist. And if it takes away atonement and Eucharist, it takes away marriage. And therefore it takes away that you will ever understand God. Because you will always rely on the Spirit. Just as some Christian Scientists will always rely on the practitioner. I know in Switzerland, I just talk from Switzerland, so not to offend anybody here. Recently came somebody to me and asked me for treatment. I said, well, do you know Christian Science? He said, oh, yes. I have had, since 20 years, I always, when I had somebody, I had a practitioner to help me. He said, oh, that's fine. Well, then, you know. Well, I said, go home and I will do my best and read once the first chapter on prayer. So this man said, what do you mean? He said, well, go home and read the chapter on prayer. And he said, what chapter on prayer? Where is, what do you mean? Well, he never heard about the Christian Science textbook. He never heard about the Christian Science textbook. He never read the Bible. And yet for 20 years had Christian Science help. Well, that I call pernicious in its tendency. And this, it isn't termed spiritualism, but it's termed Christian Science. But only termed. So I always want to mention these things just to make us realize that spiritualism isn't just something which has to do with what you can call a sect or a group of people who go to spiritualistic seances. It's a belief. It's a belief. And it's the belief that does not accept what she shows here, that love is at the helm of everything, that spirit blesses everything. Here, spiritualism goes to spirits, to people, to persons, to material personalities to get the blessing. That's spiritualism. And I come to the end of the talk. I don't want to keep you too long, but just when you read that last part, you will see how it is shown that spiritualism is a tendency which tries to keep us back in the spiritual evolution. Whereas spirit blesses all. Spirit wants us to evolve spiritually. And this evolution must take place within the consciousness of each one of us. And then it is a blessing. Just to get some healings, some advices, some guidings, isn't really a big blessing. It can be just the other way around, that it can deprive us of the best qualities, can deprive us of the qualities of prayer. And when something can deprive us of the qualities of prayer, it can deprive us of the whole textbook. Because everything is built on that first chapter. And the second chapter is built on the first chapter, and the third chapter is built on the first and second chapter. And the fourth chapter is built on the first and second and third chapter. Now, we see in this way, really, see that here in that first part, she builds a sound groundwork of showing that we must see what are really the eternal things, the eternal identities, the eternal facts, I may say, and analyzes to our consciousness what really cannot be real facts and real laws. Spiritualism. But she does not yet in this first part really explain the phenomena of spiritualism. See, what we have done up to now, if she would leave it at that, at this point finish the chapter, then every spiritualist with right could come along and say, but you just say spiritualism is nothing. But we can prove to you that there is such a thing as a spiritualistic phenomena. Come once to our seances, and we show you how a table lifts itself up without anybody moving it. We show you how a table or a chair begin to tap and tap without that you move it. We show it to you, and they will show it to you, and we'll show it to every one of us. So, this first part does not yet explain the phenomena of spiritualism. That we'll do tomorrow in the second part. In the second part, she will show Christian Science comes and must, if it claims to have the truth, must with that truth give an explanation for these phenomena. And must show that these phenomena are phenomena which are seeming real in the realm of physical perception, but they are not real in the realm of truth. That's a different thing, and that we'll see tomorrow. But for the first, but in order to show that, she first had to give a clear-cut basis, so to say, a clear-cut basis where she showed that only that can be real which is identified by God. And that everything which is not identified by God directly cannot claim to be true. I have here a little paper which one of the students gave me. And this student tried to put into a nutshell really the what I would call the essence of these first part, the subject of this first part. She wrote it like this. She says, she takes these different subjects and says, because mind has identity. See, it's always on that point. Has God identity? If God has identity, which does not change, then really only that which is derived from that God is real. So she says, because mind has identity, it never creates anything else but ideas itself. That was the first point. Because mind has identities of being, therefore as mind it cannot deviate from that from being mind, and so can only create ideas and nothing else. Not things. Not thoughts of illusions. She says, because spirit has identity, it never communicates with or through its opposites. Perhaps she could have said also, she never communicates through or as its opposites. See, a spirit does that. A spirit says, I am spirit, but I communicate as matter, as material sense, as material manifestations, as physical phenomena. But because spirit has identity, it can never express or communicate itself but as itself, namely as spiritual, never as its opposite. Says because soul has identity, it never allows itself to regress. See, because soul has identity, it can never lose its identity, and therefore it never allows itself to regress or digress, both, to fall back. He says, because life has identity, it never dies. See, if life has identity, if life stays what life is, if life remains what life is, that means it has identity, then life can never die. Does never die. They are simple facts, and yet we are so afraid that we are going to die. We shouldn't. It says, because truth has identity, it never tolerates erroneous existence. See, it can, because truth has identity, can never be anything but what it is, namely truthful. Truthful existence can never be erroneous existence, but destroys erroneous existence step by step. Says, because love has identity, it is all-inclusive and omnipresent, and so dispenses all mediumship. See, because love has identity, and love always says, love never loses sight of loveliness. So love never needs something outside of itself, see, all-inclusive, and therefore dispenses of mediumship, because it's always conscious of its loveliness. And that is a real salvation for us. The real salvation for us, when we begin with spirit, deduce everything as spiritual and to a spiritual universe and explain it spiritually, then we are in the eternal rhythm of spirit. Then all that does not coincide with this logic of the science of spirit must be considered as belief. And when it's considered as belief, then comes the second part, which we will take tomorrow, which says, all right, then what you must see is that you don't believe the belief, but that you free yourself from the belief. And then the third part comes, that liberating third part, which says, all right, accept that you always were the Son of God. Accept that you are the expression of God. Go out from that perfect standpoint. It's very beautiful. Tomorrow we'll take that second part. We'll have a jolly good time tomorrow with that second part.